Hello and welcome to Crosscut Talks, a podcast replay of Crosscut's live interviews with the people who shape our world. I'm Mark Bumgarten, the news and politics editor at Crosscut. There's no question that wildfires have been getting worse. They're bigger, stronger, and more destructive than ever before. And the fire season is longer than ever before, too. This is especially true in the western states. Last year, for instance, California experienced the deadliest wildfire in state history, killing at least 85 people, destroying 14,000 homes, and burning an area the size of Chicago. With yet another big fire season predicted in the region, Crosscut gathered a panel of leaders to discuss what we can do to manage this new normal. Ken Pimlott is the former chief of CAL FIRE, the largest firefighting agency in California. Before retiring in December of 2018, he spent 35 years battling wildfires in the state. Hillary Franz is the Washington State Commissioner of Public Lands. Elected in 2016, she's responsible for managing 6 million acres of land in Washington and leads the state's wildland firefighting team. Cody Dizitel is the Natural Resource Director for the Confederated Tribes of the Colville Reservation in eastern Washington. He's also a member of several state-level groups, including the Washington State Wildland Fire Advisory Committee. Crosscut's Science and Environment editor, Ted Alvarez, moderated the discussion. This conversation is sponsored by Comcast and the Nature Conservancy. It was recorded on May 4th, 2019 at Seattle University as part of the Crosscut Festival.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to What to Do About Wildfires. In the western United States, we've moved on from asking whether bigger and bigger fires are the new normal and just accepting that as a fact. And our guests today, they work on the front lines of battling some of those fires. I'm just going to go down the line and let them introduce themselves to you guys.
Hi, good afternoon. Ken Pimlott, as Ted said, just recently retired chief of CAL FIRE, and CAL FIRE is the California Department of Forestry and Fire Protection, responsible for 31 million acres of wildlands, predominantly private forest and watershed lands throughout California, now overlaid with the challenge of almost 40 million people living in the state and many living or recreating in the urban interface. All of that has come together with the challenges of a changing climate, and as we'll talk about today, just the last 3 or 4 years have been extremely challenging for California as well as the West and here in the Pacific Northwest. So we'll certainly talk more about that today, but my career has been over 30 years working both as a forester and resource professional and a firefighter. Started out my career with CAL FIRE in 1987 as a seasonal firefighter and worked my way throughout the state, ultimately being appointed by Governor Brown as the director in 2011. So thank you.
Good afternoon. I'm Hillary Franz. I'm Washington State's Commissioner of Public Lands. I was elected in 2016. I'm one of the statewide electeds, and I lead Washington's wildland firefighting team, as well as I oversee 6 million acres of land, about 2.6 million acres of aquatic land, 2 million acres of forest land, 1 million acres of agriculture, and then a pretty significant commercial and industrial portfolio of land that funds about $325 million a year for your schools and your counties.
Good afternoon, everybody. My name is Cody Dizitel. I'm the Natural Resource Director for the Colville Tribe. The Colville Reservation is approximately 1.4 million acres. I have a big natural resource staff that works in my division, approximately 500 people. We've had a lot of fire over the last 15 years, roughly 500,000 acres on that 1.4 million acres. So a lot of experience in fire. My career grew up in forestry and fire primarily, and I've been the Natural Resource Director for the last 5 years.
Great. Well, I'm going to start first with a personal question. I'll start with Ken, but we'll go down the line. And I'm curious what personal connections you have to wildfire that inform your approaches. I know that you fought your first fire famously at 17 years old in your hometown, but I'm curious about what personal experiences sort of inform your approach.
Well, really, it did start with that. My dad worked for the Forest Service early on in his tenure, growing up and recreating and hiking all those things in the mountains and foothills of California. But for me, really grounded in starting out as a seasonal firefighter and working throughout California, and quite frankly, experiencing a lot of the changes and a lot of the significant events that have happened over the years. I think, like for many of us in the business, didn't anticipate ending up, certainly in a leadership role. We start out because we want to be, out on the fire ground and doing that work. But it's really engaging and seeing the difference that you make on the ground. Certainly young, you're in the adrenaline rush and you're feeling that part. But as I've matured over my career, it's really getting a broad understanding of what's going on, the impacts fire is having across the landscape and the changes that are there. And it's really the roots of being experienced in that in the very beginning days of my tenure that really helped.
So my background, environmental land use attorney in Washington State for over 25 years. Much of my work is very much about the context of leveraging policy and investments to be working in the context of prevention versus response. When we look at our state right now, we are spending about $153 million annually to fight fires. We have seen not only the number of fires double, but also the geographical range. So last year we had 1,850 fires in Washington State, largest our state's ever had. 40% of those were west of the Cascades. Our state usually is not funding the work up front to invest in the forest health and the forest science to be able to make our forests more resilient. And it hasn't also been funding the prevention, having the resource and capacity on the ground in our communities so that we can get on those fires quicker and contain them and protect our landscapes and our communities. So I come from, a background of really leveraging science and policy and good, smart investment and having a plan in place to be able to make sure we're setting this state up for success and we don't continue to just throw money at a problem in sort of reacting. As I always say, we're going to pay for it regardless. The question is whether we're going to pay to react to smoke and fire and potential loss of life and environment, or we're going to pay to be proactive upfront, helping make our forests more resilient in a rapidly changing climate and be able to have the resource and capacity to get on the ground and protect those forests in our communities.
And for me, again, most of my career spent in forestry and fire, largely in forestry. So a lot of background in forest management with the goal of that forest management, trying to make those stands resilient to insect and disease and fire, with the long-term goal of making sure that the landscape, the 1.4 million acres we have left that the tribe has management control over, provides all those things that are important to the tribe, like fisheries, like habitat for wildlife, like cultural resources. So the 1.4 million acres we have, we hold near and dear, and we manage it very well to make sure that the needs of the tribal membership are met for the long term.
This is a kind of a follow-up question to that, but I've read a little bit about how in the Colville Reservation you have the ability to employ some strategies that can inform other agencies as a whole. What are some of those that you've seen some success with or great promise that you think other agencies would maybe do well to adopt?
I think our management strategy aligns fairly well with the state, but the pace and scale that we do it at is much faster than most other land management agencies. So if we look at just purely forestry, of the 922,000 forested acres we have on the reservation, we've probably done some type of forest health treatment to, I would guess, north of 200,000 of those acres in the last 10 or 15 years. So we're very active in the way we manage, trying to push those stands back to the adequate stocking levels, the correct species composition, and make sure that we have a balance of forest structure across the landscape. So when you see fire, you don't see these huge catastrophic swaths of high severity fire. You see a mixed severity like you would have seen historically.
This is a follow-up that's for all of you guys, but when it comes to managing healthy forests, some of that thinking kind of runs contrary to maybe some classic environmental thought, which is like walling off forests as places to be protected. Now, as you're kind of moving back into that thinning and that type of those practices to keep forests healthy and keep fires from getting too big, what types of communication do you employ to get the environmental community on board with that type of practice?
So let me start first with the problem here in Washington State so people really understand and grounded in it. And I would say to you that we're actually seeing a lot of diverse stakeholders coming together, recognizing the problem, and also knowing what is the solution. So in Washington State and Eastern Washington alone, Central and Eastern Washington, we have 2.7 million acres of forest that are dying. It's due to drought, insect infestation, disease. You can watch, and I've watched with my own eyes, starting last March, where I saw 100 acres within 3 months be decimated by a moth, right? Where it was a living forest, and then 3 months later, it was completely on its route to death. We recognize that if we don't get on top of this forest health crisis and really set forward a plan in Washington State, we will continue to see not only the dying forest, but we will see more catastrophic wildfires that lead to like what we saw in 2015, where a million acres burned in Washington, which isn't just bad for the forest, but bad for the salmon and all the wildlife habitat, as well as communities. And as we all experienced last year, Washington State from Spokane to Seattle had the worst air quality in the world. So we developed in 2017 a forest health plan, which has us treating 1.25 million acres of forest over the next 20 years. It's about 70,000 acres of forest. We are attacking it and we brought different stakeholders. We had everyone from local fire districts to the environmental community, like Nature Conservancy, who is sponsoring this, as well as the timber sector and local government, believing and recognizing that this is a problem that as long as we keep closing our eyes, we are only going to make it worse. So we specifically brought in forest health scientists, one of the preeminent one who now works at my agency, and we are developing a watershed approach to the treating 1.25 million acres. So they're looking at it at a watershed level. They're being agnostic to property line, since we know that disease and insect infestation and fire does not recognize boundaries. And we're specifically setting forth what are the specific treatments that need to happen. Much of it is off the leadership of our tribal communities who've been leading in this work for quite a while. Going in, removing the dead, dying, and diseased trees, not all of them, it's a certain amount. Removing those trees that are smaller diameter. If you look at our forest, they've gotten, and you looked at historic patterns before man was even in the woods here in Washington State, you would see that our forests were not as full and dense. And what happens is all of these trees are competing for water. And as a result, every tree is becoming weak. And so we go in there and we create a set plan that removes the dead, dying, diseased trees, the smaller diameter, gets enough of the space between those trees. We'll oftentimes also bring prescribed fire into those woods, because fire is not unusual for our woods. It's just that what's happened, we see it in such a severity because of the diseased trees. And so we have found that project by project, we are actually really receiving broad support. We've also are doing projects on federal land, because half of our land that's dying is on federal land. And we have communities and the scientific community, the environmental community, all recognizing that we've got a new reality here in Washington State, and we're going to have to get on top of it if we're going to actually save the environment and our health.
I'm curious, whenever these fires get out of control, at a certain point, it requires an amount of interagency cooperation that feels overwhelming. I'm curious, when is an example, I'll start with you, Ken, of when everything happened the way it should, when all of the organizations kind of came together, just basically if there were any strategies that help, forward-thinking strategies that help these disparate organizations come together to tackle something like this.
Absolutely, and California is either fortunate or unfortunate to have been, you know, facing this challenge many decades ago, no different than what Washington, Oregon, Pacific Northwest is really getting into right now, or has been in the last few years. We learned early on in 1970, where there were so many fires burning throughout California, state, local, and federal agencies were not communicating with each other. They used different fire hose threads. They used different radio frequencies. They used different terminology. And all three levels of government were responding to the same fire, taking their own operations independently on the same fire, weren't coordinating the use of resources. It was, I won't say it was a disaster, but it was very poor public policy, poor governance in the face of a public safety crisis. So in 1970, the state formed what was called FireScope, Firefighting Resources of California Organized for Potential of Emergency. Essentially, it's all levels of government that get together, and we focus specifically, and it's governed through statute, and we focus on standards for training, for response. It's where the incident incident command system came from that we now enjoy nationally. And so that is the system that we put into place every day, whether it's the smallest emergency all up to these large disasters such as the Camp Fire in Paradise. All those operate under the same framework. And within that, we have agreements with all of our partners that allow us to access resources, coordinate that. We have a system that shares one common system that allows us to move resources regardless of jurisdiction seamlessly throughout the state. Now, not to say that it isn't challenged during these large conflagrations where we're looking at whole communities burning, where we very rapidly, and I think that's what was very different about what's occurred in the last several years in California versus previous years, has been we very quickly, I mean within hours, accelerated our request for resources from local, regional, and state all the way up to going outside of California and then going outside of the country to Australia and other countries. And we continue to refine and figure out ways to improve on our agreement process, but it's been very beneficial to have agreements in place ahead of time. We exercise these agreements every year so that the process is well orchestrated. And we have one set of command and control and governance so that everybody knows clearly who's in charge. We all agree on that governance up front.
Yeah. Oh, I'd love to jump in that because we're in a way very fortunate to have learned from California and Cal Fire because you have been sort of ahead in the challenge, right, in facing that challenge. You know, after the 2014 and 2015, 2016 fire seasons, which were the most significant in our state just on the amount of acres burned, we really had to look at ourselves, not only my agency, but also local and federal agency, and say, how are we doing in facing this wildfire crisis? Because it wasn't a one-off. It wasn't an anomaly. We saw it as going into the future likely. We knew also we weren't going to get new resources. It wasn't like there was a new funding stream to provide the resources in wildfire response. So we specifically brought my agency, I called local, state, and federal agencies all together and said, we have to learn how we are going to fight fires together better so that we're not one agency trying to tackle it. And what we've done since is we've developed a 10-year wildfire strategic plan, the first one the state's ever had, which is not just one agency developing a plan, but it's a local, state, and federal agencies working together. What we've also then from that is we are now coordinating all of our training. So my agency now runs the largest wildfire training so that we're not meeting for the first time on the fire line, our local firefighters and our federal agency firefighters, but we are training together so everybody has adequate training and has the same training and that they're coordinated, collaborating before they even get to the fire line. I always say, what team, like for the Super Bowl, ever meets for the first time at game time, right? And it should be the same case with firefighters, especially when it's about their lives and the community's lives. We also leverage our resources and equipment together. So oftentimes we might own the helicopter, but we will have a federal firefighter pilot running that because we only have so many resources and capacity. We also work at the state and federal level to get more resources to our local fire districts who are oftentimes the first in defense when we're seeing so many fires across the landscape. So it's because of our coordination that even though we haven't had new money to be able to fight these fires with, and we're still fighting the fires with the same helicopters we've had, that all of them, all seven of them, fought in the Vietnam War. And I always say to people, how many are you driving the same car you drove in the Vietnam War? Go ahead, anybody? Right. I've only met one person in 2 years who is, right? But our pilots are going up in very challenging, hot conditions with equipment from the Vietnam War. We have to do better with the resources we have, but we also have to start investing in those. And that's the partnership we have with local, state, and federal agencies.
And the one thing I think I would add to that is recognizing what fire seasons have done across the country. So everybody across the country's fire season has expanded. What was typically a 90-day fire season is now 120 or 150-day fire season. And we've lost a lot of the infrastructure. So looking at Oregon and Washington as an example, we used to have 12 incident management teams, if I'm remembering right, about 10 years ago. We now have 6 for both states. So we need to do a better job of managing how we use our resources so that we're effective as possible and making sure that we're effective at suppression so that we can get folks off the line, because something that I think we will likely see in the future, and it's regrettable, but there's just so much exposure to firefighters right now. They see so many hours on the line that it's just a matter of time before you see an incident. And those incidents could be very tragic in situations. So that's something we're very cognizant of. We realize that we're part of a national firefighting resource and that you need to share yours whenever you don't need them versus having other folks come up and help you when fires are burning in your part of the country.
I'll just add, because I know you experienced it, that's a great point. So historically, California and Washington have always had a mutual aid agreement, right? So your season would start earlier than our season, and so we would send firefighters down to California. And then by the time your season was slowing down, ours would start up, and you would send back. Well, your season is now 365 days of the year. It really is. And we found last year, when our season started in April and was going well into October, we had a lot of our team was very, very tired. And we were trying to bring in new people, right, to give people enough rest. Colorado was on fire, Oregon was on fire, California, Montana, Wyoming. We couldn't find firefighters in the state. We had to go to Australia. I had more firefighters sometimes from Australia than I have of my own full-time firefighting team. That's the challenge we have, where mutual aid, whether it was local, state, and federal, or cross-state jurisdictions, or even cross-country jurisdictions, was a lot easier. But because fire is now prevalent in many of our states and many of our countries, we are limited in resources. And one of the things we're saying is we've got to set Washington State up to be successful and dependent on our own resources, because we never know how bad it's going to be for our neighboring countries or neighboring states.
So another problem probably is that people are moving into these exurban areas. That interface is just an area of expansion. In many cases, it's an attractive place to be. I know that in the past, some people have proposed possibly limiting how many people can move there. What are some strategies to deal with that type of movement of population into fire-prone areas?
So this is a challenging area, and certainly in California, just like many of the other states here in the West, that's where people are moving. Challenge we have, there's an affordable housing crisis throughout the country. And so people are moving to areas they can afford, where they can have a quality of life that they want. The challenge is that we move into these areas is putting more and more pressure on the local systems to support that. The real key are local land use planning decisions to address this pressure. And in California, back in 2008, we passed some very strict wildland urban interface building standards. It had to do with roofing requirements so that it was fire resistive, had to do with fire resistive construction on the exterior, road widths, water supplies, address marking, all of that. But that was only 10 years ago. And what's been burning in all of these fires is this legacy construction that goes back to the 40s and the 50s. And we have not been able to figure out how to address that retrofitting of existing infrastructure, how to improve ingress and egress routes. The community of Paradise that literally was wiped off the map in the Camp Fire last fall had been trying to address that through local fire safe councils. They had added additional escape route. But it was all woefully inadequate based on the threat that they face. So the challenge we have to look at is we have to continue to look at this sort of from an all hands approach, in that building standards, ensuring we've got ingress and egress, it's fuels treatment, it's defensible space, it's public education, it's the broader forest management, because outside around these communities or intermixed within this are our forested landscapes. And so there's a whole other equation here about ensuring we're using tools like prescribed fire and other harvesting of law, all of that to really attack this problem as a whole. But it's going to continue to be a challenge as we have population pressures continuing to move in, you know, to these areas. And we have to make some tough decisions about where we should and where we physically just can't build, because there's no way to protect these homes.
You know, we've had areas in Washington State where most people would know they must be prone to wildfire risk, right? I mean, we know parts of central and eastern Washington where year after year we've seen it. They're not a stranger to it for even the last 10 years. I think the new reality is that we now have whole parts of our state which would never have imagined themselves in a wildfire risk, but now they are. right? So let me give an example. This year alone, we've already had 170 fires. In the second week in March, we had 54 fires in 1 week. 53 of them were west of the Cascades. It's the first time we've seen fires that early in the year. Those fires were in Wakayakum, Grays Harbor, Pacific County, Cowlitz, Thurston, Mason, right? These are counties that would never have seen themselves as being part of a wildfire risk. But because the snow that we had gotten, that rain in the early parts of the year, had quickly dried up with some beautiful, gorgeous days. I have to tell you, since taking this job, I hate the sun in Washington State, which I never thought I would ever say. But it dries up so quickly, especially when we've had such little moisture. So we're facing a new reality of places that people thought were never see wildfire or could never see wildfire are already seeing it. We are doing better about really mapping those areas. We, of course, started with the central and eastern part of the state so that people in the land use planning would bring that awareness in to that planning. But we are living with a legacy already as one of the fastest growing states in Washington State for quite some time of a lot of areas who people who love to live in their treed areas, and those trees were healthy and they were moist for many parts of the year, not being anymore. We are working right now to develop, and partly we're lucky by the latest legislative package to actually move a social media marketing campaign on FireWise and Fire Adapted Communities. So we're not just one house at a time, but going similar to like the context of energy efficiency or other wholesale campaigns to actually get whole communities actually treating every one of their yards, every one of their landscapes. And I'll give an example really quick of Roslyn is a community just on the other side of the Cascades in the Ellensburg, Kittitas County area. That community faced two significant fires in 2017 that almost burned that town down. And that community has risen up and said, we are going to take an entire town radius and make sure every single home and every single landscape is more resilient in the face of fire. And they are already in just 2 years have rapidly escalated their work. And they will be a model, frankly, for other parts of the state, not just on the east of the state, but the west too.
And so for the Colville Reservation, this is a good and bad thing. So through our land use planning, we've kind of restricted where folks can go, recognizing what these challenges are, not just from a fire perspective, but say they're elders or people that need emergency services. If they're out in the woods, they're just tough to get to. So we've kind of tried to restrict where people go. And we've put a lot of time and money into doing fuels treatments directly around the towns and then forest health treatments to further increase that buffer. So when we do have fire, we've got a lot of defensible space there that we can try to do some things with. The downside of that, using 2015 is the example that when they're allocating suppression resources, they go, well, Colville, I think, is in pretty good shape. They don't have many people out in the wildland urban interface. They've got quite a bit of defensible space, so let's send all of the suppression resources somewhere else. So what we saw was in the North Star fire alone, 220,000 acres burned, and we were north of 100,000 acres on that fire before we probably had 100 people on the ground because they went everywhere else, the Chelans, the Clallams, the Okanagans, everywhere they had populations that had done, in my opinion, a poor job planning land use. And so we disproportionately suffered because we'd done a good job. And I'm not sure how you fix that other than to have everybody else fix the problem so we're kind of all on the same playing field.
Any ideas for how to fix that?
Well, it starts with resources, right? And I'll just, I mean, I have to give a shout out to the legislature and also to my agency who's really worked tirelessly in raising sort of the attention of the importance of this issue of wildfire and forest health. This year, we were able to secure $50 million to finally have more resources and capacity, not only in doubling our firefighters. We have 43 full-time firefighters and we're the largest firefighting agency of the state, but also being able to get two more aircrafts and also other equipment to our local communities that are also struggling. I think that's a first big step in actually investing in prevention versus putting all the money on the back end in response.
It also occurs to me and I've seen you propose and other people talk about the fact that you will have to knit. You mentioned the fires in March, for instance, that were mostly on the west side. So, you know, if in the past we were able to put it out of our mind, anyone on the west, and say, well, that happens mostly over there. Now it's clearly intermixed, and solutions are going to have to come from both sides of the state and possibly link up together. So it occurs to me, and I know you've proposed things where there's actually economic opportunity here, where you can solve several problems at the same time, where the Venn diagram overlaps pretty neatly. So I'm curious if you could walk us through a few of those solutions, basically for economic opportunity and fire prevention.
Yeah, so I think it's great. You know, in my job, I see a lot of challenges. We're on the front lines of a rapidly changing climate, everything from floods and landslides to wildfire to ocean acidification on our waters that we manage. And it would be a really bad day if every day I just focused on all the problems and just said, because they're all very intractable and very challenging, as we see. What I like to do is say, look, we see a series of problems, but all of these are part of an ecosystem. So how do we start looking at it as an opportunity? So a perfect example is really in the wildfire forest health issue. We have 2.7 million acres of forest that are dying and causing a wildfire crisis. When we go in and treat those forests, we remove the dead, dying, diseased trees. We remove the smaller diameter trees. Now through new technology, we're able to take those smaller diameter trees and the dead dying trees and actually create a wood product that is actually more sustainable than concrete and steel, and is also more affordable. And I look at that as that if we can through the forest health treatment solve our wildfire crisis and our forest health crisis, be able to turn that product in, go to the mill, and actually create cross-laminated timber or mass timber, we now help grow our rural economy, which is significantly struggling. In our case, in many of our communities, they have 9 to 12% unemployment for generations. They aren't seeing the economic boom some parts of our state are seeing. They then turn into product, comes right back here to the cities where we have one of the largest affordable housing and homelessness crisis. And that's a place where we can tackle multiple problems with multiple win solutions. Part of the 20-year forest health plan, when we announced that and then partnered with the legislature to secure funding to do that work, we sent a message to the marketplace where now we have two cross-laminated timber facilities, one in Northeast region up in the Okanagan-Colville area and one in the Vancouver-Washington area now being developed, which will now be able later this year to actually create the first cross-laminated timber beams in Washington State, and will quickly be coming here to the King County Central Puget Sound area where we are grappling with some of the most affordable housing and homeless crisis maybe even in the nation.
I think for people who don't live in fire-prone areas, this problem can seem insurmountable. You can feel powerless, like in the face of something so big and intimidating. What are things you would tell people? What can they do? Somebody who maybe doesn't live in the intermountain interface, but they want to do something. How can they get engaged?
So I think that's one of the bigger challenges that we face, is that in California, the voters reside in the Los Angeles Basin, in the San Francisco Bay Area, the Sacramento-San Joaquin Valley. Many of them may not be exposed to the wildland-urban interface. We have to continue to draw connections to literally when they turn on their faucet, where they get their tap water from. In the case of California, over 60% of the water in Southern California comes from the Sierra Nevada Mountains north of Los Angeles. And so it's us continuing to try to socialize the work that we're doing and the direct and indirect impacts of what's going on in our wildlands with the very things they live with every day: water, air quality. And I think both Hillary and Cody talked about it. We'll have fires in the Central Valley or the Central Sierra, Northern California, and we will send smoke thousands of miles away to Idaho, to Nevada. So we're impacting air basins, and airsheds thousands of miles away. So how we articulate what we're doing. Some of the things we've been working on and really trying to capitalize on is social media. We have a Ready for Wildfire application for smartphones that allows you to log on and see what you can do around your home, gives you some guidance, but it also provides real-time updates on where wildfires are burning around the state. So this tool is not only for an emergency information alert system, but also provides the ability to educate people every day, regardless of where you live in the state, as to what's going on around the state.
How about out here in Washington?
On the specific things people can be doing?
Yeah.
Well, social media is good. If you guys go, one of the things we've noticed is about over 90% of our fires are caused by humans. And most people might feel perilous, like, what can I do? There's nothing I can do with the changing climate, drought conditions. But the fact is 90% of our fires are caused by humans. And a lot of us that are going out in the woods or live in the woods, especially now in the western part of the state, are not familiar with how fires get started. So those 54 wildfires that we saw in the middle of March, 53 of them west of the Cascades, a majority of those were brush fires. People, we know the sun's coming out, and they said, it's time for me to get on my spring garden cleaning, and they began doing brush fires. Well, they weren't so used to the landscape being as dry in March. And then you bring in the wind to that, and pretty soon we had 130 homes being evacuated in the Cowlitz area because a neighbor needed to do his brush fire that he's so used to doing. So really being aware of what kind of behaviors are not helpful as we see a change in climate, changing conditions. So brush fires, another context we see oftentimes, believe it or not, you shouldn't be parking your car on dry grass. Most people are like, I even got this, I was like, what? I never thought about that. How many of you go to fairgrounds and park your car on the dry grass? Well, turns out you got a hot muffler, you got spark comes out of that car. Make sure your tires, this is going to sound really crazy, my team will go, what? I saw a fire last year in the west side. I was coming back through Kitsap County and from work, and all of a sudden there was a massive fire about a 500-acre fire, and it got started because a guy's tire fell off his car as he was driving, and all it takes is that metal hitting the ground. You get one spark and the dry side of our roads. Don't throw cigarettes out of your car. I mean, there's a lot of things that people can be doing, and we're just not used to Washington State being as dry as it is. And people, we need to build that awareness. You can go to our website and find more, but also creating that defensible space around your house is important.
So the one thing I would add to that is how we perceive fire. So people understand the huge implications of wildland fire in the summer, and those are typically July, August, sometimes September fires. But I think we need to change the dynamic about how we approach fire suppression. So there's a lot of potentially beneficial fire that could be happening in April, May, June, or maybe late September, October, but that means people have to live with smoke for a longer time period. It's probably going to be lighter smoke, more sporadic. It won't be those socked in, can't see 100 yards for 2 weeks at a time like we see in the summer. But as you start to live with smoke outside of the peak of fire season, you can start to see some of those positive benefits of the use of either prescribed fire or prescribed fire use. So it's a wildfire that you're managing to try to treat some fuels issues, because it's largely an air quality issue. So we struggle with trying to get prescribed burns done because they're subject to either permits from Department of Ecology or from EPA for us, because you don't want to impact people's human health. But they don't count wildfire smoke, which makes no sense to me. It has the same impact. Smoke is smoke in somebody's lungs. I don't think your lungs care where the smoke came from, but the density of it, the amount of particulate matter, that stuff has human health impacts. So the way to start to turn this tide, and it will take some time, there will be probably smoke for 9 months out of the year if we're being really successful, but what we'll start to see is a moderate amount of smoke for a longer period of time versus really intense, heavy amounts of smoke right in the heart of fire season. And that's, again, like you're saying, we're seeing, depending on the weather patterns, smoke going thousands of miles.
Well, I want to make sure we have a bunch of great questions from the audience. I want to make sure we have time to get to that. So Emily asks, when an area is particularly prone to fire, when do you tell a community and developers they cannot keep rebuilding because the risk is too high? I think she's asking about specific...
Like a development.
Yeah, like a specific places that are prone.
Well, I can tell you from the California perspective, this again has been a challenge, as we talked about. California maps all of our wildlands, and we rank them, and we identify those that are considered very high fire hazard severity zones. And that's based on vegetation, topography, and now we're bringing in weather patterns. And then that is, by law, provided to all local governments to look at when they're making land use planning decisions. And the challenge we have is those land use planning decisions are made at the local level. And so what will happen is all of the other influences of developmental pressures come into play. You know, what's in that county's general plan and the public safety element of their general plan and their hazard mitigation plans, and what what are they looking at for infill? All of these things come into play, and then they're looking at tax base and economically underdeveloped and housing availability. All of these things come into play and start putting pressure against the fire chiefs and the local officials when they're talking about areas that are challenging to be developed. As I was leaving my job at the end of December, I made some very bold statements about we need to really think hard about these urban interface areas and look at areas where maybe we just can't build because there's no way to mitigate through additional ingress and egress routes or vegetation modification or even structural improvements to harden the structure. There are just some places that we've determined that are just physically going to be impossible to protect people or structures because of where they're located. Putting a house at the mouth of a canyon that's aligned with the wind, and in the case of the North Bay fires in 2017, 80-mile-an-hour winds, you know, blew down canyons into Santa Rosa and burned an entire subdivision well away from the wildland. So we're looking at fires in areas where we never even imagined them being at before. So we have to really look hard at these areas. We have to make some difficult decisions. We need to continue to work locally. And this is really an area where there needs to be a loud voice, particularly locally, where these decisions are made to be able to identify when it physically is not possible to be able to provide that level of protection and we can't mitigate it in other ways.
Okay. Let's see. Here's an interesting one. Is the key to fighting wildfires to establish a full-time federal wildland fire service? Why or why not?
No. I think, you know, and you should definitely jump in on, I'll just say from Washington's experience, I think the way we are now setting up a plan for our 10-year wildfire strategic plan of really leveraging our local, state, and federal agencies as one team is really the answer. If we give everything to the federal government, we know how federal budgets go like this, right? We are basically giving away our survival and our success to the federal government, who may care or not care about our state, who doesn't necessarily fully have the full understanding perspective. I think local, every one of us has a value. So the local, our local firefighters, they know their communities best. They know egress and ingress. They know how fire has faced structures in that community. They also know how fires have faced the landscapes in that community. They are an asset. Unfortunately, in many communities that are fire prone, especially because more of these are in our suburban rural, they don't have a lot of resource and capacity. Some of these are volunteer firefighters, so their levies, they can't raise or increase their levy, and so the revenue isn't there. That's where the state agency, where we have much more ability at a resource level and an experience and expertise level. We tend to have people in for a long periods of time, 30 to 40 years. They know the topography. They know when fires come through that community and how it played out. We also have the ability at the legislative and the federal level to bring in more resources and capacity and the right types of resources and to spread them geographically in those areas where fire is prone. The pattern of fire in Washington State changes every year. So the way we fight fires is we're looking directly at, we have a meteorologist that says, here's the weather conditions this year. Here's where we're likely to see more fires based on lightning strikes, based on the dryness and the conditions of the forest. So we bring that information where local fire districts and federal wouldn't necessarily have that specific ability at the state level. We then say we're going to pre-position our fire resources in those areas so that they're able to get on those fires quicker. And we will pre-position them and then we'll move them as the fire is changing and the season is changing. So honestly, I think it's really very much local, state, and federal agencies all have value. The key in any state is them working as one team and not being, not working separate from each other or not communicating and collaborating.
So I'm just going to build on what Hillary said. In California, we were fortunate that decades ago, the state invested in a state fire protection system because we recognized that the state was sort of the glue between the local government, our first responder partners, and the federal agencies. And so we have a strong, large organization that provides that same expertise that Hillary just talked about. But it works because it's coordinated through this organization that and organizations that we talked about earlier. But it's unique and different in different parts of the state. I will tell you, Southern California, it's almost a year-round federal presence because the national forests in Southern California are impacted by fire fire almost year-round. So there are challenges, even on federal land, to being able to provide, because of the population pressures, people recreating. Again, California, 95% of the fires are started by people. Where are the people in these large areas? Well, you've got national forests, public lands, that have a fire problem year-round. So there are some policy questions that go on and have those discussions every day, because sometimes the state and our local government partners bear the brunt of having to respond to federal fires because of funding and other infrastructure challenges. Things that, again, have to continue to be discussed. It's not one size fits all. The key literally comes back to exactly what Hillary said. It's this coordination and to putting agreements in place and to ensure that we're all singing from the same sheet of music and are unified in our approach going forward.
This is a question that I think speaks to a lot of confusion and curiosity, and it ties into something I was hoping to get to, which is climate change hanging over all of this and how that kind of works its way into the ways that you all communicate about this. And the specific question is the current wildfire situation primarily due to decades of fire suppression, or is global warming the major factor right now, or is it something else? I think it reflects like a discomfort with that, being able to talk about that in an educated way and how, you know, it's all layered on top of each other.
You want to start? Want to start and I'll follow?
So I would say it's all three. I would include wildland urban interfaces, the other big component in that. And I won't say too much because I'm sure these guys have something to say too. But yes, that everybody has a recognition. Fire seasons are longer. Fires are burning more severely than they were in the past. The way that we're attacking fires is more effective than it was 20 years ago. I think people see increased fire acreage as a lack of firefighting infrastructure or a lack of good firefighting decision-making, and that's not the case. We work together much better now than we did when I started my career. It's just the conditions are so much worse. So I think this goes back to the things we've talked about, that if you're gonna make a change and start to move the needle the other way, you need to make sure that we're managing forests appropriately, that you're creating landscapes that are resilient to fire and ecosystems that are resilient to fire, so you have all those ecosystem services that we spoke about earlier, and then that we have a well-trained workforce that has the ability to respond and make good decisions in the face of fire that we will see for the next 20 to 50 years, because it will look different. I mean, the experience I have now, what I saw in 2015, I hadn't seen in 20 years of fighting fire. So this is a time of change, and it will take some changes to make sure that we can address it appropriately.
I mean, I would agree. I mean, the reality is the earth is not a stranger to fire. The challenge we have is that we are seeing changing conditions in our climate, hotter, drier seasons, longer, hotter, drier seasons. We're seeing, in addition to that, the connection that we haven't actually managed our forests in a way that is truly building the resilience that they need to a changing climate, to increasing insect and disease and infestation. And we've now need to bring them together to be able to set our forests and our landscapes up for success. You add in there, obviously, a growing population and more increased people living in those areas, which makes it even more significant. But all of this, we are seeing the changes. We have the ability to create forests that are more resilient to those changes. We don't have time to waste.
And just 100% agree with both Cody and Hillary. And I think when I opened and talked about what I see has changed in my 30-year career is that we, literally, California, that has all these resources, all these fire departments, all these things we see on CNN all the time. And literally, you know, in the last 2 years, we have very quickly accelerated from using all our resources locally to placing requests outside of California, nationally and internationally, to respond 2 years in a row and anticipate that same thing could and most likely will happen again this year. As Cody said, there just aren't enough resources to go around. The challenge is we're not going to solve this problem today or tomorrow. So we've got to continue to invest to make sure we have the best training, the best set of resources, the best coordination. We can't give up on protecting property and resources and lives. But if we're only focusing on that, we are going to miss the entire set of this equation that's going to allow us midterm and long-term to start getting ahead of this. And that's all these other things that we've talked about, starting to engage in everything to sort of break this cycle.
And I'll just add, I mean, this issue is not just tied to forest health and wildfire. I mean, we are seeing a massive, dramatic amount of changes within our environmental world in the context of drought, in the context of ocean acidification, in the context of reduced in-stream flows for our salmon, in the context of actually we're experiencing dust storms like, and it's only growing. As I manage 1 million acres of land, we see it every year. We have to start working to invest in what we already know is the problem, and how do we set up our state to be more resilient in the face of a hotter, drier conditions or more increased rainfall and snowfall at certain parts of the year, and many times we don't have. The solutions are out there, but we have to start to value putting those solutions in place now versus waiting till it already becomes a problem that is noticeable. And I'll just, on this piece, I'm assuming many of you are from the west part of our state. I'm assuming many of you felt like last year's wildfire season was the worst wildfire season ever. Yes, we had more numbers, but we only, and I hate to say it's only 440,000 acres burned last year. And I say only knowing how significant that is, but in 2015, 1 million acres burned. It was far worse, the damage and destruction, even the cost to the state. And we even lost lives that year, unfortunately and tragically. The reality is that much of the damage and challenge of wildfires has largely been borne by the central and eastern part of the state, where they experience it year after year, that air quality we experience on the west side. So it is becoming new phenomenon or a new challenge for the west part of our state, but it is something that has been in place for over 5 to 10 years of a crisis in the central and east. And the same is going to play out when it comes to drought and food production and our aquatic resources and our water resources. If the sooner we get on top of this and start investing in the solutions now, the less pain we're going to face for our communities, our environment, and our economy in the future.
Excellent. Well, I think that's a hopeful place to end things. We've reached the conclusion of our time, but thank you all so much for being here. And thank our panelists, Ken and Hillary and Cody. So we'll see you out there. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to Crosscut Talks. This week's episode was recorded by Resty Bacall and produced by Sarah Bernard. Audio from the Crosscut Festival was recorded by Seattle Theater Group. You can subscribe to Crosscut Talks on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, or wherever you listen. For more on the Crosscut Talks podcast, go to crosscut.com/talks. And for the latest political, environmental, and culture news from the Pacific Northwest, visit crosscut.com. If you'd like to attend the next Crosscut Festival, the dates have been set, May 1st and 2nd, 2020. And if you want to let us know what you think we should talk about and who we should invite, go to crosscut.com/festival and give us your suggestions. Crosscut Talks is a product of Cascade Public Media. I'm Mark Bumgarten. We'll be back next week with another episode.